This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's time to play Family Feud!
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Tonight, Family Feud. Progressive Democratic presidential contenders Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren sparring over questions of gender and electability.
And Family Feud. Going into tonight's Democratic debate, the last before Iowa, a fight breaks out between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
The rare Progressive Family Feud coming after Senator Elizabeth Warren confirmed reports that during a private conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders in 2018, he told her a woman could not beat President Trump.
The de facto non-aggression pact between the two progressive senators seems to be out the door.
It started last weekend when Politico reported that the Sanders campaign had given some volunteers a script with talking points for winning away voters who were leaning toward other candidates, including Warren. Then CNN reported its bombshell.
Sanders told Warren he did not believe a woman could win, according to four sources, two people Warren spoke with directly and two others familiar with the meeting.
The gossip that routinely stands in for actual election news, like one of those tasty pirouette cookies that melts in your mouth, leaving nothing behind but a sugary residue. CNN made much of its nothing.
Anderson, there is no question that we've seen debates before. We've not seen a debate like this.
We are just about an hour away. Will tension between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders finally boil over?
That's the big question. That is what everyone is waiting to see.
The debate was 2 hours long, the last before the Iowa caucus. But for CNN, it was all about that last 17 seconds.
They had a moment after the debate. Warren left Bernie Sanders hanging when he tried to shake her hand, and that was followed by a brief but tense exchange, including Sanders' hand gestures and a return of a gesture there from Elizabeth Warren.
What could the silent gestures have meant? Politico got a body language expert to do a move-by-move analysis of their exchange. News outlets noted that hashtag NeverWarren had begun trending on Twitter.
There were Bernie supporters who were lighting up Twitter yesterday with anti-Warren hashtags.
It wasn't trending because a critical mass of voters were turning on Warren, but because the algorithm had picked up on users cautioning one another from tweeting the hashtag. Like a finger trap, the harder progressives tried to de-escalate, the more the feuding seemed to spread, drawing more eyeballs, more clicks. And then, just as the post-debate news cycle had reached its natural crescendo, CNN released audio of the handshake snub during Anderson Cooper's primetime slot.
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
What?
I think you called me a liar on national TV.
Let's not do it right now. You want to have that discussion, we'll have that
Anytime.
Discussion. You called me. You told me. All right, let's not do it now.
It was a soup to nuts CNN win, a well-timed, anonymously sourced piece that produced days of TV drama. But did the feud tell us anything new about Sanders or Warren or how they govern? And given our country's history of misogyny, was it even sexist for Sanders, if he really said it, to suggest that a female candidate faced insurmountable odds? Writing in The Cut this week, Rebecca Traister says the question, though dispiriting, is inevitable.
Can we acknowledge that in a country that has only elected male presidents throughout its history, that gender is a factor both in all of the elections of men that have preceded us and is a factor that's going to shape the path of female candidates in such a way that it certainly had an impact on Hillary Clinton in 2016. But it's like people then, when they get to the point where they can acknowledge that, speed right by it and get to, well, it's impossible. We'll never be able to elect a woman because everything's so sexist. It's somewhere in that middle ground that we are right now.
Warren, until now, hasn't directly taken on questions of whether she as a woman is electable.
I have been watching her framing of gender with tremendous interest. She gave her opening speech in Lawrence, Massachusetts, talking about young women who organized in the textile mills in Lawrence and Lowell, Massachusetts, in the early 19th century.
On January 11th, 1912, a group of women who worked right here at the Everett Mill discovered that their bosses had cut their pay. And that was it. The women said, enough is enough.
She gave a big speech in Washington Square Park in New York in the summer about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory and the kind of organizing and striking that had preceded the fire there, and then specifically about Frances Perkins, mm-hmm. who had witnessed that fire and then went on to work in Roosevelt's cabinet. And without talking about herself, she was making a not-so-subtle comparison between how a woman can look at systems that are broken and then move inside a system and fix what's broken. And it does two things. It enables a feminist approach to her historic presidential campaign without having to engage the incredible tinderbox that is about her own experiences of bias or sexism.
And you said, all that's over now. We're in the muck.
Sure are. Yes. that's done.
Because then on Monday, CNN reported that in 2018, multiple sources say, none of whom were Warren or Sanders, that in a private conversation, Sanders told Warren he didn't believe a woman could win. When he was asked about this during the debate, he was emphatic.
It's incomprehensible that I would think that a woman could not be president of the United States. Go to YouTube today.
One of the things that Sanders campaign has said in its defense in this conversation is, here, look at these videos of Bernie Sanders talking in 1987 to school children, third graders.
You, just as much as the boys, have a right to become president. There's not been a woman president.
And then in 1988, telling C-SPAN, of course a woman can be president. There's a difference between saying in 1987 and 1988 that in theory, yes, of course a woman can be president. And the question of a woman running against Donald Trump. And I can absolutely imagine a scenario where Bernie Sanders says he's going to throw everything at you. He's going to drag you through the mud. And Warren says, so do you think any woman can beat him? And I can mm-hmm. imagine him not thinking that he was giving any kind of definitive prediction and it hitting her like a ton of bricks, because it's mm-hmm. her prospects that her friend and colleague and feminist is describing. When she ran in Massachusetts for the Senate seat that was then occupied by the very popular Republican Scott Brown, she told me in the summer of 2018, just a few months before this dinner with Bernie Sanders, how clearly she remembered the progressives, her friends, who called her and said, you can run for this, but you should know that a woman is never going to win in Massachusetts. Scott Brown mm-hmm. had beaten another female candidate, Martha Coakley, to win his seat in 2010. Massachusetts had a terrible record of electing women in politics prior to Elizabeth Warren. And Warren was so frustrated. So it doesn't surprise me at all that if there was a conversation, which Bernie Sanders might legitimately not have thought he was offering any definitive prediction of doom, but she being very sensitive to all the ways in which she's been told women can't do this in the past, heard it. I think people have exchanges like that all the time in which meaning is extracted differently.
But Twitter's gone bananas.
Yes, of course it has. This is the first time in my life that there has been this kind of competition in a presidential context between two such left-leaning politicians. And people are driven by their passions for these politicians. And it's been a very tricky proposition for Warren and Sanders fans, because they went in with a kind of truce, and yet they both want to win. But the complaint that I had about Bernie's response was, he said, no one in this room thinks a woman can't win the presidency. No one says that. And that is simply not true. As a feminist journalist who has written about this for years, I have had thousands of conversations with people, some of whom are like jerky sexists or whatever, but most of whom are fellow feminists who are deeply worried about this question. And by the way, I absolutely believe that a woman can be elected president in 2020. I believe that there is every chance in the world that Elizabeth Warren could be elected president in 2020. But the thing that is not true is that no one would say that. We have never managed to do it before, and women are more than half of the population. The only way we ever will elect a woman is if we all decide we want to elect a particular candidate who is a woman and we get over the fears that we can't do it. I mean, that's the catch-22 here, is the more this question guides our thinking, the more it becomes self-fulfilling prophecy, because we worry about it so much that we reach for what looks like the past that we know we have elected in the past, like Joe Biden, who's literally been in power for 5 decades.
After Bernie made his statements, the moderator turned to Warren and said,
Senator Warren, what did you think when Senator Sanders told you a woman could not win the election?
As if Sanders had never spoken at all.
So I thought the phrasing of that question, which just took as gospel Warren's recollection and openly rebuffed what Bernie Sanders had just said, was really irresponsible. I also thought it was bad for both of them. It is obviously bad for Bernie because the moderators who are framing the terms of this discussion, in that moment, they're not even registering his differing view of events. So it's obviously bad for Bernie in that way. But it is also bad for Warren because, of course, Bernie's fans hear that, understand it to be a sign that he is being victimized in this. And these are the dynamics that are so perilous whenever you have a conversation about sexism. The power dynamics are so easily reversed so that the marginalized person becomes the aggressor, and the person who in any way is asserted to profit from marginalization becomes the attacked. And so the fact that Bernie is in fact treated badly by CNN becomes more evidence that he has been wronged in this situation. And that's not good for Warren. But we also need to talk about the timing of the CNN piece. And I want to do this without in any way impugning MJ Lee, who is a terrific reporter who wrote the piece and has been a great reporter on the Warren beat.
But the timing
of a piece, it didn't come out of a conversation that happened on Sunday. It didn't have to be published right now. There was a choice made by CNN to publish it on Monday before a Wednesday debate that was aired on CNN that published the piece.
The ratings for the debates have declined. The first one drew 18 million. The last one drew a little over 6 million. CNN got 7.3 million for this one.
I don't think there's any way to say that there wasn't thinking that this is going to draw attention. We can't take a look at all of this that's happening between the candidates and assume it's just happening in nature.
Let me pick up on women's anger. I think that there's been just as much commentary about that final moment. She gave Bernie the cold shoulder. As you've observed, women in public suffer far more than men for lying.
Characterizations of dishonesty do stick really hard to women, not exclusively women, but they stick really hard to women candidates, something we saw in 2016 around Hillary Clinton, who sort of by every factual measure was actually a fairly straightforward politician and yet got incessantly tagged as devious, conniving, untruthful, dishonest. We've seen that with Warren, I think, in part criticism around her handling of the DNA question and stuff that Trump has been throwing at her for a while. She's gotten this stuck to her very early, and it's not rational. I actually wrote a piece a few weeks ago about how her competitors, including Joe Biden, right? Like Joe Biden is a guy who was thrown out of the presidential primary in 1988 for plagiarism and, not only that, lying about his own academic record. He's been caught in a million of these, and yet he has this, like, no malarkey Joe reputation. It doesn't stick to him as a character trait, but the littlest things have gotten stuck to Warren. And again, I want to be clear, this isn't something that happens exclusively to women. It also happened to John Kerry. It happened to Al Gore, although I would note that both of those men also wound up being feminized by the press in their presidential runs.
Frenchness of John Kerry?
The Frenchness, the wealth, parasailing, his thrall to his very powerful wife, Teresa, who was wealthier than he, right? And Gore, who, if you remember, Maureen Dowd once described as practically lactating. There are strong associations between femininity and dishonesty that actually the very brilliant scholar Salamisha Tillett told me in 2016 in reference to Hillary Clinton, it's almost biblical. So the question of did Elizabeth Warren lie, it is a very perilous moment for her in that regard. The question of anger and how she presents herself is a slightly separate question. She has been relentlessly upbeat. She's got the energy of the golden retriever, right? That's like her mascot.
Kate McKinnon captures it perfectly.
Hello, Vinton. Hello. It is good to be here. Look at me. I am in my natural habitat, public school on a weekend.
But she's very smart and can be very cutting. And of course, she can get angry. And she's talked about anger unapologetically throughout. She was talking about it in the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings. She was saying, I'm not going to apologize for my anger. I own my anger.
Bernie says he's sick and tired all the time.
All men on campaign trails get to be angry. In men, it's a sign of passion, commitment, drive, patriotism. We know that there are these double standards. Warren has actually been pretty direct, I think, experimental in her willingness to say, yeah, I am angry, and that's part of what's driving me. She talks regularly about being in a fight. And what you saw at the end of the debate was a moment I actually thought it was incredibly humanizing for both of them. They are longtime colleagues, longtime friends, who are both in this election because they are so committed to trying to fix everything that is unjust and broken in this world. I really believe that about both of them. And now they're in conflict with each other and they were mad at each other. To me, it was so human about both of them. They're mad. This is ugly. This hurts. I don't think either one of them is lying. And I write a lot about how women get criticized for being angry all the time and men often get congratulated. And Bernie has been congratulated for conveying the anger of his supporters so effectively. But it is also true that Bernie is one of the men who's also been criticized for it. I mean, he is also a real challenge to the power structure. And part of how he's punished for that is through characterizations of his own bad temper. He yells and he hectors and he points and all of that.
You've observed that getting to cry sexism is treated as a privilege, as a present. And on MSNBC, Chris Matthews was praising Warren's canny handling of the issue with his usual frenzy.
All right, and I think bringing this out into the open, the issue of whether a woman can be elected president is going to help her campaign. And whether she started it or not, she definitely brilliantly exploited it tonight. And then Bernie clinched. I thought it was very interesting. He did not want to fight it anymore, but she won.
This is one of the perils of ever talking about the bias that you have faced. You will be perceived as having won the lottery because you get to talk about how you've been discriminated against. It's all tied to the reactionary inverted views of affirmative action or identity politics, where it's worse to be called racist or sexist than it is to experience racism or sexism. That is such a popular ingrained assumption. I think in so many of the people who run our media institutions, which are still fundamentally white patriarchal media institutions, that like the greatest danger is that somebody might call you a bigot, not that that person might have experienced bigotry.
Rebecca, thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure.
Rebecca Traister is a writer at The Cut, where her recent article is called The Third Rail of Calling Sexism. Coming up, does consuming all that politics make you depressed? Our next guest has a plan for that. This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.